Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Earlier on in the week, I was chatting to Professor David Thunder, who's a lecturer at the University of Navarra in Spain. And he'd written recently about his thoughts on the storming of the Capitol building in the United States. He thinks that this event was the symptom of something much deeper in terms of political division in the United States. And he started off just explaining his reaction to it.
Naturally, I was concerned and saddened to see that American democracy is in such a bad state, but also watching some of the coverage of that storming of the Capitol in American media such as CNN, but also European media, I noticed that the coverage, the analysis was quite superficial, because they focused basically on who did this and what connection did it have to Trump. That was kind of the question that was in their mind, whereas I see this as part of a larger process of erosion of the legitimacy of American public institutions that has been going on since the 1960s. And just to take one example, a piece of evidence for that, national surveys in the United States show that in 1964, 77% of American respondents affirmed that they trust the government in Washington always or most of the time. That percentage, 77% of trust, dropped in 2019, it drops down to 17%. That's an enormous drop in trust.
It's a huge drop in trust, David, but is it an excuse for actually what happened, just in terms of the how these people ended up in this building and the violence that ensued as well?
Well, I don't believe that you can excuse that sort of violence, and I do see it as a defiling of the symbols of democracy. But I think that it's one thing to excuse something, it's another thing to understand and contextualize it, to understand how it came about and what it actually is symptomatic of. It's not something you can fix by just changing the president. It's indicative of the fragility of American democracy at this moment. It would have been unthinkable in 1964, say. I think it would have been unthinkable for a bunch of supporters of one president to assault the Capitol. And now look what's happening. They have assaulted the Capitol, and they have stormed the Capitol. And I think that basically it suggests that there is a declining sense of legitimacy. 25% of Americans, according to different polls, actually believe that the election was stolen. They believe Trump, even though I believe the evidence suggests the election was not stolen, but I think that's very worrying, that a quarter of voters, of American voters, would believe that.
One of the things, though, David, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, is obviously we're talking about, when you think of the 70 million or so that voted for Donald Trump, this was obviously a very small percentage of that. Was it an extreme minority, or is it representative of a wider troubling discord in America, do you think?
Well, I do believe that it was an extreme minority. However, it's also true that it's too easy to just say it was the work of extremists and then just sort of move on. In reality, it's a bit like a disease. You know, when you see that someone has a high fever, you have to ask yourself the question, what is going on in the body? What is the pathology? What is the disease that is at work? And I believe that this was a symptom of a larger process of disenchantment with the political process in America. A lot of voters voted for Trump as a protest against the mainstream politics and against Washington, D.C. And those voters remain out there. And I think that by CNN and other news outlets that dismiss those voters, or that sort of pretend that this is just a matter of a few extremists, I think are not doing any favors to democracy, because those voters who voted for Trump and who feel disenchanted with American democracy will have to be reintegrated into that democratic process, because if they're not, then there is a danger that America could split, and it could actually, the United States could fall apart in coming generations.
But you would imagine, David, that many of those who voted for Trump saw it as an affront to democracy, what happened in terms of storming the Capitol as well. But there hasn't been, or one could argue that there hasn't been an attempt, as you say, for the mainstream media to understand this disconnect between, you know, those who perhaps voted for President Trump and the mainstream media, who don't really try to make an effort to understand the why behind this disenfranchisement.
Exactly. I think that Trump's election was a wake-up call, and there was a moment in which the media, in which journalists did seem to admit that they had gotten it wrong, that they did not understand the American electorate, and that they should listen more to Trump, to the kind of people who voted for Trump, to understand their concerns. But I think that in the face of this storming of the Capitol, this crisis, they've retreated to their traditional position, which is that Basically, that there's a mainstream position that is basically broadly a liberal position, and then there are extremists who would do this sort of thing. But they forget about the middle, let's call it Trump's more middle ground voters, who are not extremists, but many of whom would identify with Christian values, with traditional family values, and basically feel very excluded from American media and public discourse and the political process. What to do about them? That's the question. What to do about them? What you can't do is ignore them, because if you just keep ignoring them, then they will feel increasingly, alienated from the political process, and the Congress will no longer be representing them.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Have you got a job interview coming up, and how do you manage it nowadays when it's going to be done most likely on an online platform? Well, I chatted to interview expert Sinead English earlier in the week, and she gave five really good tips in preparing for an online interview.
So the first five things that you should try and fix, and these are all within your control, is number one, your broadband connection. So test it out beforehand. If you know that your house, or where you're going to be doing the interview from, has a habit of the broadband, the Wi-Fi just dropping every now and then, it's not a good idea to do it from there, because the whole way through the interview, you'll be worried about, am I going to get to the end of it without the connection dropping? So fix that. Do a line test. And if it's just really, really bad, maybe you could go on 4G. Maybe you could go somewhere else within your 5K where you could get a better signal.
Yeah, or sometimes in our house, Sinead, what we have to do is, because we don't have great internet, is everybody else has to turn off their Wi-Fi, and then it makes the Wi-Fi stronger. But test beforehand seems to be the advice.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think everybody now in every house in the country, family WhatsApp groups, and the number one message is, get off the Wi-Fi. I'm about to do an interview or I'm about to do something. So number one, test it. And test it at the time that you're doing the interview. The Wi-Fi could be fantastic at 9 in the morning. It could be terrible at 4 in the afternoon. So test it at the time you're doing it. So that's the first thing, broadband connection, Wi-Fi. Second thing is your background. So depending on the platform that you're using, you might be able to blur the background. You could put on a virtual background. And if you can't do any of those things, then make sure that the background that they're seeing is a tidy background. Now, it doesn't have to be pristine. Some people go to great lengths to put bookcases behind them with very knowledgeable...
Yes, they have a cultivated book collection that you wonder if they've ever been opened.
Exactly. You don't need to do any of that stuff. Just make sure it's clean and tidy. We did an interview once with somebody. It was a video interview, which was pre-recorded. And this candidate did the interview in front of an open fridge. So the fridge was open behind them.
Oh,
it was
gosh.
The most bizarre thing. All I was doing was trying to see what they had in the fridge. Like, it was crazy.
I know. I'm getting hungry rather than listening to the interview.
Yeah.
Okay. So think of your background. Very important.
Think of your background. If you can blur it, great. If you can put on virtual background. You know, don't try to be too clever about the virtual background. Just something fairly plain, it's fine. So that's the second thing. The third thing is the lighting and the position of the camera. So we have seen some candidates do interviews on video where the light source is right over their head. So they're in a room with a pendant light, you know, shining on them, and they look like some sort of ghost because all the shadows are coming down on top of their face. Similarly, if you're in a room where the light is to the side of you, one side of you will be lit up and the other side of you will be in shadows.
Okay, and you just look strange. And again, it's really distracting.
It's really distracting. And, you know, they talk about making eye contact in these interviews. If I can't see your face, well, that's the first disadvantage. So sit in front of the light source, whether that's in front of a window, if it's during the day, or set up a lamp and put that in front of you and just try it out. I mean, you can go on, you take a photo of yourself on your laptop or go on FaceTime or one of those apps that you can actually see yourself before the look hole goes on to make sure that the lighting is right. So check the lighting. Now, remember, you haven't even said anything to them yet and you're doing all this stuff in advance, but it is going to stand to you when you actually start the interview. Yeah, so check the lighting and the position of the camera. That's the other thing. Prop up the camera or your laptop so that the camera is at your eye level.
And that's one thing that I think people find difficult as well, just in terms of where the camera's at, Sinead, because, you know, are you meant to look down straight into the camera lens, but then that's hard because you're not actually looking at the person and it's hard to connect with them then.
Yeah, exactly. So my next point is, my number four is look at the camera. Your temptation is to look at the screen, right, because all the action is there, the person that's interviewing is there, and you know, if it's a panel interview, you could have three or four interviewers, all their pictures on the boxes on your laptop. But you need to be looking at the camera, because when you're looking at the camera, what they see is you looking at them. They see you making eye contact with them. And as hard as it is to not keep straining your eyes down to see, oh, how am I looking on the camera, or who's everybody else there, you need to be looking at the camera for most of the time. So one tip that we give our clients is to just get a post-it note, a little sticky note, put a smiley face on it and stick it right beside the camera and say, look here. It just reminds you to keep looking up there.
Yeah, very good advice.
Keep looking up there. And then the fifth one is to do a trial run. So you've never used Teams before and the interview is on Teams. Well, do a trial run with a friend of yours doing a Teams call. So to make sure that you're logged into the right platform, the worst thing you want to be doing is struggling to connect with the call because you don't know how to, minimize pop-ups, or you don't know how to give your laptop access to your camera. That is major stress when you know that there's an interviewer waiting on the other side for you to get your act together.
What about, Sinead, making an impression? Because, you know, one of the things I always remember in advance of an interview is that whole thing of the impression that's made in the first few seconds, and things like having a good handshake and all that sort of stuff. But in the absence of that physical contact, how can you make a good impression?
Well, again, it's about being prepared. So when the camera comes on you, that you're not looking down on the ground, or you're not struggling to figure out which way up the camera is, or that you're not halfway sitting down, like that you're ready to go. As soon as that camera comes on, you're ready to go. You look at the camera and you say, hi, good morning, nice to meet you.
Is there any other things, you know, just general tips for people to take on board, Sinead, especially kind of around nerves and things that they can prepare in advance? Obviously, it depends on the type of industry and stuff, but in just kind of general tips of those kind of regular questions that are asked, you know, what's your biggest flaw and where do you see yourself in 5 years? Are they still kind of common enough questions?
What you can do, and, you know, when we're working with clients on interview training, and we certainly go through this a lot in the book, is you can predict about 90% of the questions that they will ask in an interview by just looking at the job description. So when the job description says that we need people who can work under pressure and who have experience in client onboarding and who can work in teams and who can solve problems, you know, or it's very likely that the questions they're going to ask you are all going to be related to those particular things in the job spec.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
A bullet-ridden chapel on the River Jordan in the West Bank where Jesus was baptised has held its first church service in 54 years. I was joined earlier in the week by the editor of the Irish Catholic, Michael Kelly, to talk a little bit about its significance and its history, and he started off explaining about when he himself had visited the site.
Yeah, I have been, and I feel kind of privileged and frightened to have been there before it was possible to visit, because as you say, it was littered with landmines, and at the time that I went there in 2007, that was still the case. So, you know, we very, very closely followed the army jeep that was in front of us that had drawn out a way for us to get to the spot in the River Jordan where Jesus was baptized. It was at the time a closed military zone. But if we go back much farther, and just to put this spot into its historic context, just how important it is, if you go to the year 1250 BC, so that's, you know, 1200 and a half years before Christ. This is actually the place where the ancient Israelites crossed into the Promised Land for the first time, when they crossed the River Jordan and they came to the Promised Land. So as a result, it's called Qasr al-Yahud, you know, the Tower of the Jews. So that's hugely important for the Jewish people. And then you fast forward to the beginning of Christ's public ministry, and John the Baptist is baptizing there in the River Jordan, and that is where Jesus is baptized. Now, Franciscan friars who have a strong love of the Holy Land ever since St. Francis visited there in the year 1219, they started coming to this site in the year 1641, and right up into the 20th century, this was a hugely important site of the Christian pilgrimage. Now, I don't want to bamboozle people too much with dates, but if we look at the kind of the geopolitics of the situation then, so when the UN partition plan in 1947 was established for roughly what we now call the Holy Land into a Jewish state for Israel and a Palestinian state, the land that was supposed to become part of that Palestinian state, now what we call the West Bank, that was immediately invaded by the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. They crossed the river, because when you're at this site, it's quite something, because at the time of Christ, the river was much wider than it is now. Now it's probably only about probably only about 6 meters wide, and there's like a yellow line in the middle of the water, and that's the border between that's the border with Jordan. But 1967 comes the Six-Day War, and as that suggests, it lasted for 6 days. But during that time, Israel took the land from Jordan, and that border became the line. And as a result, because it was the front line in the conflict between two countries that wasn't at the time resolved, it was littered with landmines all over the place. And so the religious communities who had lived there for many, many years, they weren't able to visit because of the risk of the landmines. But over time, you had the peace agreement between Israel and Jordan, and lo and behold, they've just completed the removal of a lot of the landmines, meaning that it's a place that large numbers of pilgrims will be able to visit once again. So it's hugely important, and I suppose what's really fascinating about it as well is you just see how the modern day political situation just sits side by side with so much biblical history there, going back to the Israelites crossing into
the history. Is really fascinating, especially when you consider what happened there in later years in terms of the baptism of Jesus. What do we know about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a site from the very earliest times that has been associated with the baptism of Jesus. This is where the earliest accounts indicate that St. John the Baptist was baptizing there in the River Jordan, and where Jesus came to be baptized. Now, many pilgrims who have been to the Holy Land on pilgrimages have probably been to another site. Yardanet is the name of the other site, but it is never claimed to be the site. It was simply opened as an alternative whenever they weren't able to visit the one that was there. But the Catholic Church and many of the other Eastern churches who have property and land in the Holy Land, they, along the banks of the River Jordan there, they set up monasteries, they set up chapels, and these have been largely unoccupied since the Six-Day War. But now the hope is to actually open hostels in the site, so people will actually be able to stay there as part of their pilgrimage, because sometimes now if you go there during the daytime, it can be very crowded and you get a lot of pilgrims. But the idea would be that if people were able to stay in the hostels there, they could go down and be by the River Jordan by themselves at nighttime and reflect on just the importance of baptism for all Christians. But it's a beautiful site, and it's a huge joy for me to see it open, because when I visited there in 2007, and you know, you have the Jordanian troops on one side and the Israeli troops on the other side, and you're following this little kind of armed convoy so as to avoid landmines, I just thought to myself, you know, how sad that the Holy Land, how sad that this land associated with the earthly life of Christ has all of these landmines. And it's just great now to see that so many of them have been removed, and there's plans to entirely clear the site over the next few years. So if you are staying there in your hostel tonight, I wouldn't go wandering too far, at least for the time being.
Yeah, and it's I would imagine the atmosphere of the church being opened has been an incredible one. But put in perspective, Michael, just how significant this recent church service is at the chapel after such a long time.
Well, this is the first time in 54 years that liturgy has been celebrated in this chapel. And one of the interesting things is for the Franciscans, when they arrived back, they found it largely as they left it. Because bear in mind, this was a very volatile situation in the war, so they didn't have a lot of notice to leave. So the friars who were there, the other monks who were in the different monasteries, they all left literally just with the shirts on their back. So it's quite remarkable for the friars now to return and see, you know, the writing desks of the friars who were there back in 1968, you know, the unmade beds, the chapel, much as in the way that they left it. I mean, obviously, the bullet holes are on the wall from the various firefights that there was between the Israeli Defense Forces and the troops of the Kingdom of Jordan, and you know, various other conflicts in the 1970s with Palestinian militias as well. And I think one of the interesting things is they've decided not to fully restore the churches. They've decided to leave the bullet holes there on the churches of the monasteries as actually a sign that this place stands as a symbol of peace in a very volatile part of the world.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
One of the things that was made very clear in a positive way in the Mother and Baby Homes report was the different attitude that the Regina Chaley Hostel, which was spearheaded by Frank Duff, had in terms of trying to keep mums and their babies together. Earlier on in the week, I was joined by Fionnuala Kennedy, who's written a book all about Frank Duff's life, and she started off just explaining to me a little bit about how the Regina Chaley Hospital came to care for pregnant mothers.
They had about 12 or 15 women in the Regina Chaley when a pregnant woman arrived at the door, and he said, "Why not? You're very welcome." And that is actually the start of the Regina Chaley, and a special unit within it called Matter Day for unmarried mothers and their children. And it really happened almost providentially, you could say. He hadn't set out to establish a refuge in any sense for unmarried mothers. It was for homeless women. And this evolved then very rapidly, and it became very well established and very successful, you could say. I mean, the women, many of them went out and took jobs when another woman would share the childminding with them. And he always laid great emphasis on the fact that the legionaries were entirely voluntary, were providing a service, not a charity. And the women made a very small contribution, as did the men, to their upkeep. So it was, and it was open to all sorts of creeds and colours and so on. It wasn't.
And really, Fionnuala, was it one of its kind in that one of the focuses was trying to keep mum and baby together?
Oh, that was the absolute critical point. And I remember actually talking to Frank Duff about this. I was quite young at the time. And he had a really almost visceral instinct about the bond between the mother and the child. Now, he encouraged fathers to play their role also, and many of the women from the Regina actually got married, sometimes to the father, sometimes to different men who accepted their previous child or children. But he had a very, very strong, incredibly strong,
instinct, as you say.
I remember my most poignant and lasting memory of Frank Duff was one time I was up in the hostels, and somebody had died, somebody quite relatively important in terms of the Legion hierarchy, and there was Frank Duff sitting in his chair with this young boy who had a very enlarged head, and Frank Duff had his hand cupped behind his ear, he had poor hearing, and he was wrapped in attention. And I asked somebody, "Who is this boy?" And said, "Oh, that's John. He comes here every day after Mr. Duff's lunch." And eventually the boy moved out to a home in Chapel Izzard, and he died at quite a young age. And I asked Frank Duff about him, and he said, he said it would have been very difficult for the battle of life. But his priorities were very focused on children and mothers, and on every individual, really.
And one of the things that, or maybe you spoke to Frank about it, Fionnuala, I don't know, but what must it have been like then for all those who are volunteering in Regina Caoilí, who were also seeing, you know, the other attitudes and what was happening in Irish society? That must have been quite difficult and heartbreaking as well.
Well, there was great spirit amongst the Legionnaires. I remember some of the women, and a lot of them would have been single women from the civil service, who were very, for their time, were very successful women, many of them. I remember Miss Bodkin, who was the first, I think she was the first woman to qualify as an actuary in Ireland. And she was a sister of Thomas Bodkin, who became head of the Birmingham Art Gallery. There were really sterling women, and Celia Shaw, who was the first woman to get the administrative officer exam into the Department of Finance and lived in a beautiful house off Aylesbury Road. But they were all very low-key. One thing about the Legion is they never look for credit and they never look for publicity, if in fact, would avoid it. And in the few times I was in the hospital, there was a great sense of humour. And I remember one time I went up, I think, to collect Mr. Duff to drive him somewhere, and one of the indoor sisters, as they were called, these were full-time volunteers, said, "Oh, I think Mr. Duff has lost it." And I said, "What's wrong?" And they said one of the women, I think, had had five pregnancies and was pregnant again, and they were losing patience. And he said, "No," he said, "she's absolutely a sterling mother. She's a wonderful mother. And I think she was just taken advantage of." And these women were being, I suppose, a little more judgmental, whereas he was saying, "No, she's a wonderful mother, you know, and full marks."
And so he just sounded like a really caring man. What about just the sort of person he was, and especially in thinking of women in these particular circumstances, and even that example that you've given, Fionnuala, what was Frank Duff like?
He was very normal, very ordinary in many ways, highly intelligent, highly, highly intelligent. A core of steel, as well as a very caring, very gentle man. But I have often found that with men in general, that the ones that you think are tough, who are bluster and shout and so on, they're not really. They can often dissolve. And the really toughest men can often be quite gentle, but with this core of steel. And he certainly had it, because he had to overcome the most ferocious opposition.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Is it ever possible to truly heal wounds that run very, very deep? This is something that I talked to Johnny Clark, who's involved with Youth with a Mission in Ross Trevor, and we were reflecting in particular on Ireland's historical situation in terms of the Troubles. And Johnny shared some really good insight in terms of his experience and the work he's done. And he also started off just sharing a little bit of his own personal experience.
Before we moved to Ross Trevor, my wife and I had a community. We lived in the Shankill Road and the Falls Road in Belfast, which are obviously two of the most iconically kind of troubled and divided streets in the island, probably. And we saw firsthand the peace walls and huge walls and separations and the demonization and the dehumanization of each side. And at that point, church unity ceases to become a theoretical concept and a nice little talking shop. And it becomes what I think Jesus always intended it to be, which is an active, it's like a more like a verb. Unity becomes a verb instead of just an adjective. One of our big mentors at that time was a guy called Father Jerry Reynolds, who was a Redemptorist priest from Limerick, who had moved up to Belfast in the mid-80s. And he saw people shot, and he walked every single day of his life back and forth across that wall to comfort those who were bereaved from both sides. And we used to participate in the Good Friday walk with him. It was one of many things we used to do. We'd carry a cross, and Catholics and Protestants from both sides of that wall would walk between those two iconically divided roads and express the unity that God wants us to have. And so unity really at that point becomes something that you're doing. It's something that we, as we go into the world, we seek to show that we love one another. I think for me, the probably the most sobering moment of my life was as a 19, 20-year-old. I was a New Zealander by birth, but had lived here since I was 9 years old. And And I was in Mumbai in India on a kind of a Christian outreach to tell people about God. And one day I got into a taxi, and the taxi driver was a Muslim guy. And he said, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Well, I'm from a country that you've probably never heard of. It's called Northern Ireland." And this Muslim guy turned to me and he said, "Oh, Northern Ireland, that's where the Christians are killing each other." And, of course, for any of us who've had familiarity with the conflict here, it's not as simple as Christians killing each other. But yet that was the legacy that was known.
And that was the impression. And interestingly, Johnny, I had similar experience myself when I had a brother living in the United States. And when we would visit, people thought, you know, you're living in a war zone. What's that like? And to see that impression of what was happening in Ireland around the world really kind of put it, it was very stark, to be honest.
It's very sobering. And I think for all of us, we've got to make choices. And how can we be witnesses to, as Shane Claiborne calls it, a revolution of love that's big enough to set both the oppressed and the oppressors free. And I think for most of us in our lives, we encounter people that we find very difficult, and we just find it normal to live in a place of bitterness, unforgiveness, resentment, if not even active kind of movement against them. And we've just got to understand that Jesus showed us what it was like, that he would rather die for his enemies than to kill them. And he showed us this revolution of love that was so huge. And that when we follow Jesus, he's calling us to do radical things, like loving enemies. But as we do it, he's going to be with us. He said his yoke is easy, his burden is light. And so as we seek to kind of love those around us, and sometimes the hardest people to love are your family members, are those very close to you. But that's who God has called us to love. And as, I think as Christians, as we show that unity, it can really change the world, and it can make the world see what Jesus is like.
And when we're talking about what we're talking about in terms of just the history of our conflict and the blood that has been spilt, we have to recognise the history on the one hand, but also look to the future. But how do you do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have a history degree, and I kind of love history in a way. But I was actually just yesterday in a meeting with a former archbishop and a former moderator and a former leading Catholic figure in this island, and we were all talking about how do we, as we come to 2021, 100 years since the partition of Ireland, do we just have to move on, or how do we remember, but remember in a way that's helpful and healing instead of just re-digging up old wounds? And I think it's not easy, but as Christians, we're not called to forget the past, but we're maybe to remember it in a different way. And I think that becomes the key thing. When we remember things through the lenses of old offenses and hurts or tribalism, then we're not remembering things the way God wants us to remember. But as we remember through the eyes of love, I think it helps us to remember, you know, I can think of the Easter Rising or the Ulster Covenant or the terrorist activity and see that actually God is big enough to love all of those people, and whether they were on my side or the other side. Whatever political event is in our past, whatever hurt is in our past, we can remember it and we can acknowledge it, but we look at it through the eyes of love. We do a border walk every year. We carry a big cross across the border. We seek in prayer and in our footsteps that every footstep would be a prayer and that we'd be kind of binding up this wound, this border. And I remember the first year walking to Darkley, where there had been a big atrocity during the Troubles. And the community worker there said to us, "Johnny, are your feet sore?" And we had just walked from Ross Trevor, you know, I mean, in 2 days, it'd been about 35 miles. And I said, "Yeah, our feet are killing us." And he said, "Good, I was praying that your feet would be sore." And I thought, what the heck's he talking about, you know? And he said, "I was praying your feet would be sore so that you would know some of the pain that people in these border areas feel." And I think that really stuck with me. Now, we've done that walk for 9 years. Nine times, and it stuck with me that there is a lot of pain in this island, and it's there. Sometimes it's hidden. It's not like blisters on your feet. It's hidden beneath the facade of people's smiles, but it's there in different ways. Some of it's, you know, hurt from the Troubles, but it's there. And how is we as Christians, how are we being wounded healers? How are we helping to heal ourselves and heal other people?
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Earlier on in the week, I chatted to US political analyst Larry Donnelly about the presidential inauguration of President Joe Biden. And one of the things that I started chatting to Larry about was how he felt Joe Biden's message of unity came across, especially to those who didn't vote for them, to the 74 million people who voted for Trump, how they might have felt hearing his speech.
Well, I don't think in the speeches themselves, I'm not sure there's anything that they really could take issue with. I think one of the things Joe Biden said was that he was going to be president for all Americans, whether you voted for him or you did not. And he spoke specifically to Americans who did not vote for him. And he said, you know, give me some time and take the measure of me and take the measure of what's in my heart. And if you don't like what you see, that's fine. We can disagree. But when we disagree, that doesn't mean that we need to be disunified or a disunited states. So to that point, the speech is one thing. What's really going to matter is what the administration does and what issues it prioritizes. That, I think, will tell the tale in terms of bringing some of those 74 million people along for the ride with them. I mean, America is a splintered country. I don't like the term polarized. It's more than polarized in one way or another, or painting people into one corner or another. I think America is splintered along a number of different fault lines. And I think that Joe Biden, if he prioritizes well, I think he's well placed to capture some of the people who have splintered off. But that really is going to be down to whether he listens to his centrist instincts and governs as a pragmatist, or whether he pushes the agenda that some on the harder left might urge him to do. That's going to be fascinating to watch as it unfolds.
One thing that's, of course, fascinating for many people here in Ireland, Larry, is the connection that he has to Ireland and his Irish ancestry, which seems to be very genuine, and he did talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. He has roots in Louth and Mayo, and it's actually kind of funny, to be honest, to watch the tawdry civil war between Ballina and the Cooley Peninsula over who has more ownership over Joe Biden. I think that'll be fascinating to watch over the coming years. But to get to the bottom of Joe Biden, I mean, Joe Biden cites Irish poets. He talks about Ireland an awful lot. To get to the bottom of how committed he is, I spoke very recently to an uncle of mine, former Congressman Brian Donnelly, who served alongside Biden for many years. And my uncle was chair of the Congressional Friends of Ireland. And I said, how real is Biden's commitment on this stuff? And he said, look, Joe Biden means every word he says about Ireland, that Ireland could not have a better friend in the White House than Joe Biden, that Joe Biden will give nothing but audience and time and consideration to Ireland and the Irish people, and that countries around the world will be envious of the relationship that this country and the esteem in which this country is held by the President of the United States. Now, of course, that all has to be put into context. Of course, there still is that America First impulse is out there, this repatriating jobs, et cetera, that has to be taken into account. But all things considered, Joe Biden is very, very in touch with his Irish roots, with his Irish family, and arguably his administration, with his appointments and with his tenor of leadership, is the most Irish presidential administration in American history, even more than President Kennedy. So I think this is something really to be welcomed. I think Ireland can benefit in all sorts of tangible and intangible ways.
What about Kamala Harris, Larry? Tell us a little bit about the speech that she made and just the history that she has made as well.
Well, I mean, Kamala Harris, her inauguration, her election as the first woman and the first woman of color, I think is a hugely significant moment. One of the things, Wendy, that I notice every time I go back to the United States is that the country is more and more diverse, that our collective skin complexion is changing. And for all those little boys and girls of color, it was alluded to yesterday, I think it's really important that now they can look up to the highest corridors of power and see somebody who looks like them. I think that's fundamentally important. Now, Harris, as vice president, she's going to be an activist vice president. I think we've discussed this before. Joe Biden is 78. He doesn't have the energy he once had. Harris is going to be much more, present in the arena as VP than, say, for instance, Mike Pence was. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of priorities she carves out, how she resonates with the American people, including, for instance, some of the people who drifted and voted for Donald Trump, some of those people who might be gettable back, I suppose, to put it bluntly, how she resonates with them. And this comes in the context of, remember, Kamala Harris sought the White House this past year herself. She started off in a blaze of glory, but she quickly faded because she couldn't figure out who she was as a politician and as a leader. The spotlight's going to be on her now. It's going to be very, very interesting to see what she does with it.
Do you think, Larry, just going back to something you mentioned earlier in relation to President Biden, do you think that she will lean more to, you were talking about kind of the more left kind of extreme, perhaps, you know, fringes of the Democratic Party, or will she move back to more kind of centrist policies?
Wendy, that's the big question. That's the big question. My belief is that Kamala Harris comes from the left, that she is very much rooted in the left of the party. Now, whether there are, you know, I certainly think there are some centrist instincts there. I mean, she was a prosecutor. It depends on what she decides for herself, what course she decides to chart. And in some ways, if the president himself, you know, pursues a centrist agenda, she'll have to follow in roughly lockstep. But it'll be interesting to see, and I think she has a tougher road to hoe than what Joe Biden does in terms of winning over middle America and some of the people who voted for Donald Trump. I think it's tougher for her on a whole number of different levels, one because of who she is, but also because I think she's far more to the left inherently than Joe Biden is. So I think she's got a trickier road to navigate. But that having been said, she probably excites that young, insurgent, leftist wing of the Democratic Party much more than Joe Biden does.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.